So maybe today I want to talk a little bit about faculties, Indriya in Pali, but most specifically I want to talk about 22 Indriyas, 22 faculties that are talked about in Abhidhamma philosophy. There's a Patana condition, Indriya Pacheya, which is especially a treatment of 22 different faculties. Now, faculty is a little bit of a strange word for many. Actually, it means something like a capacity of the body, a capacity of the mind, and the capacities of consciousness. Now, these matter, mind, and consciousness are kind of the three very important categories in Abhidhamma philosophy. There's a three of the four primaries of Abhidhamma philosophy. Now, the fourth being Nirvana, which stands a little bit by itself, so I will not talk about it. Now, so in Abhidhamma philosophy, there are 22 different capacities, we can say, of body and mind. The 22 things that are important if you want to philosophize, if you want to understand what a human being is, what human existence is, what conscious experience is about, then this is an important heading that you might want to look into, that you might have to concern yourself with. What a human being is capable of, what are the, you know, the important capacities of normal functioning human beings, what a human being is capable of developing, which he might not possess to start with as a normal human being, and how faculties or the capacities of body, mind, and consciousness relate to the human experience. So the first five we find variously also throughout the suttas, which are the five sense faculties of eye, ear, nose, tongue, and body, or the capacity of seeing, the capacity of hearing, the capacity of smelling, of tasting, and of feeling. Now, these are the kind of doors through which the consciousness kind of experiences the outside world, which is why it's important to think about them, to understand how conscious experience comes about, because they play such an important role in conscious experience. And because eventually the data that gets received into the mind is what makes the mind. It is what eventually will be the content of the mind also. And now, of course, the mind itself in Buddhism is also just treated as a sixth kind of organ, sixth sense faculty. And the mind as a faculty means basically memory, this receiving capacity to receive data, to process it, to think about it, to develop intentions. These all belong to the faculty of mind, which is the sixth faculty. Then as a seventh faculty, we have life, the faculty of life, which I prefer to think of it more as a life force. So this is also divided into mental life faculty and physical life faculty.
Wherein
physical life faculty means, or the physical life means basically the life a human being is capable of manifesting. Now the vigor that you display, that is a physical life faculty. While mental life is the mental life you're capable of displaying. Now you're, how bright you are, how much knowledge you possess, how much intelligence and clarity, and perhaps charisma you possess. Now all these would come under this mental life faculty. So now some person possesses more of one and less of the other. Some person has a balance of it. Now some person are full of material, of physical vigor, but they don't have much mental life. There's not much happening in their mind. They're just what sometimes is called a meathead. You know, they're not very intelligent. They don't manifest or display much wisdom and clarity, but they're physically full of vigor. While on the other hand side, you have also people who are physically very weak. Now they don't seem to possess much physical vigor, but they are full of mental life. They are full of understanding, full of intelligence and wisdom, and can easily respond to what is happening around them. They can accumulate knowledge and share it. So all things that are manifestations of intelligence and of mental life. Then next to that, a human being also possesses the capacity for pain and pleasure. Now some people don't understand that to feel pain, how that can be a faculty, but actually pain teaches us what we should avoid. If we would not possess that capacity to feel pain, then we would just walk into the fire and finish. So this is a capacity of a human being, or of an entity, of a being, to feel pain. This to feel pain is not useless. It shows a being where are the borders which he should not cross. And it is similar with the faculty of pleasure. Now, the primary function of pleasure is to show a being what is good for it. Now, to show you what is good for yourself, what you should seek out again. But then, nature is not made for a human being, and a human being is not yet perfectly adapted to nature and to everything around it. Especially in modern times, we are very far away from being adapted to nature. In for natural people, and for you can see that in animals, for example. They can sense what is good for them. When they have some physical ailments, they know what kind of grass to chew, because that will bring them pleasure. Just the smelling of it will bring them some kind of sense of pleasure, and through that they can understand what is good for them. While if you're in close contact with the inner nature of your body, then you, for example, also will know what is good for you to eat. You don't need a specialist to tell you that. And if you eat the wrong thing, then it will produce a certain displeasure inside yourself. And that is teaching you what you should avoid. So these two are also very important capacities. and faculties of a human being. Then we have another pair of faculties, which is the faculty or capacity for goodness and the capacity for evilness. Now these things, these two things are not as such, we are not really born with these entirely. Also to some degree, you know, we carry these from previous lives, but now this is something that we acquire usually through education, upbringing, personal reflections, and so on. If we pay attention to life in a certain way, and especially if you grew up with some religious training and some religious teaching, then we will develop that faculty of goodness, that faculty that is not just seeing everyone as an enemy, is not just seeing everything around as something to be exploited, but the capacity to put oneself into another one's position, the capacity of thinking about consequences, both for oneself and for others. These are things which develop this capacity of goodness, this faculty of goodness. While on the other hand side, there's equally the faculty of evilness, or bad-mindedness. In Pali it's called domanasa, bad-mindedness, we can say. This is equally, one thing is our upbringing, our environment, and lack of, spiritual training, religious training, lack of knowledge. These make us think we are the center of the universe and everything is just there for us and we don't care about anyone or anything, not just we want to pursue our selfish desires without having to bother about consequences. Now this gradually develops into this faculty of evilness. Then we have as another faculty, we have another pair of faculties, which is the faculty of masculinity and the faculty of femininity. Now philosophically speaking, masculinity means the capacity for courage, for strength, for determination, for rationality. Now these are, philosophically speaking, these are male faculties. While philosophically speaking, more feminine faculties or capacities are the capacity of receptiveness, the capacity of empathy, of compassion, of intuition. These are faculties which are the one set of faculties is more predominant and prevalent usually in male people, male beings, while the other set of faculties is usually more predominant in women. But now, of course, every being usually will possess a kind of mixture of it. And to some degree, part of the spiritual path is to have these perfectly balanced out against each other. So a spiritual person should have the perfect balance between strength and this softness and receptivity and rationality and intuition. These are faculties that a spiritual person usually tries to combine and to balance out against each other, so that a spiritual person ultimately we try to transcend gender. It's a spiritual life in Indian philosophy is called Brahmacharya, so which is a divine life. The Brahma, the god Brahma, is said to be beyond gender. He's neither male nor female, and that's usually something that a spiritual seeker will seek to develop also. And that faculty of balance actually is equally one faculty in Abhidhamma philosophy. It's usually translated as equanimity. The Pali word is upekkha, but it has various connotations and various meanings. So I personally prefer to translate it as this capacity for equilibrium, the capacity to balance yourself against the environment, or to produce balance within yourself in general. Because equanimity sometimes has this kind of connotation of coldness to it, that you just don't care about what's happening around you or what happens with other people. But that's not the case if you would consider of this faculty more as a balancing faculty, as a capacity to balance things out. If you have some overflow of energy and feeling within yourself, then you can balance out the environment, and you can go out and do something to counteract injustice. While if you don't have any extra energy, then you pull away from the outside world. So, but both are functions of this faculty of balance. And then as a next, we have a set of five faculties which play a very predominant role in Buddhist philosophy and in the training of the mind. They're referred to as the five spiritual faculties, because they are the main capacities that we are seeking to develop with our spiritual training. They are, first, what is usually translated as faith, but then because many Westerners coming from a Christian background, where you have this strong kind of connotation, this strong emphasis on blind faith. So many Buddhists, because they understand this is not what it means in the context of Buddhism, they try to draw away from that idea of faith, so they translate it as confidence. But for myself, I prefer to translate it as inspiration, because inspiration is something that you can't really hold onto. It does not easily get this kind of connotation of holding onto something dead, because inspiration comes from the root of inspire, the idea being that some divinity, some divine energy flows into you and produces some change in you that makes you higher than ordinary a person. So that is a meaning of inspiration, and that is for me the better translation for the Pali word sada. And also I found that if you make that the kind of foremost quality, the foremost thing in your spiritual practice, that you always try to keep yourself inspired, then usually things can't go all that wrong with you on your spiritual path. Now, of course, you have to take the next step. And the next step among the faculties will be right effort, to the spiritual effort. In Buddhism, there are four right efforts. The effort to abandon unwholesome qualities in you, the effort to prevent any unwholesome qualities to come into you in the first place, the effort to produce positive qualities, wholesome qualities in you, and the capacity to maintain wholesome qualities for a longer period of time. And this comes quite naturally as a consequence of when you're inspired, then your effort is likely to be right effort. And that in turn will lead to the next factor. If your effort is right, if your effort is balanced for the removing of unwholesome states and for the cultivation of wholesome states, then clarity will arise. Mindfulness will arise. Now you will start understanding, okay, this is wholesome, this is unwholesome, this is the right effort, this is the wrong effort. Now you work that out in the process of putting forth effort. And you begin to remember what kind of teachings you have learned before as to what you should do in order to cultivate wholesome things, what you should do in order to remove unwholesome things. That are all aspects of mindfulness. So mindfulness does not just mean some kind of bare awareness. Mindfulness includes remembering something. It's basically the faculty or the capacity to clear your mind, the capacity to develop clarity of mind. And traditionally, there are four places which are the best starting ground for developing clarity of mind. Now, these are the four satipatthanas, the four foundations of mindfulness, which is mindfulness of the body, or developing clarity by paying attention to the body, by paying attention to the breath, by paying attention to the elements in the body or the body parts. If we pay attention to these, then our mind becomes clear. So this is the first foundation of mindfulness. Then as a second foundation of mindfulness, paying attention to our feelings, whether we have pleasant feelings or whether we experience unpleasant feelings or whether we experience neutral feelings, and whether we experience sensual or carnal pleasant feelings, or sensual or carnal unpleasant feelings, or sensual or carnal neutral feelings, or if we experience sensual or spiritual pleasant feelings, or if we experience sensual or spiritual unpleasant feelings, or if we experience sensual or spiritual neutral feelings. Now we make this distinction, and by means of that, our mind becomes clear. Or and then we have as a third foundation of mindfulness, paying attention to the mind, learning to recognize, this mind is a mind with anger, this mind is a mind with delusion, this is a mind with greed, this mind is concentrated, this mind is scattered, this mind is well developed, this mind is narrow and undeveloped. If we learn to make these distinctions in regards to our mind, then equally we develop mindfulness, we develop clarity of mind, which is what this factor, this spiritual faculty, is all about. And then as a fourth foundation of mindfulness, we have paying attention to the Dhamma. Now there are various Dhamma teachings that we can pay attention to, remembering the Four Noble Truths, remembering that the six sense bases are suffering or remembering the hindrances to mental development and spiritual development. And if we remember, basically if we remember any of the teachings we have been given by the Buddha or any spiritual teaching, then equally by means of that we develop clarity of mind. And that is a factor which helps us to progress. And if we then progress in clarity and in our capacity to make distinctions in regard to right and wrong, wholesome and unwholesome, then slowly we can develop the fourth of these spiritual faculties, which is samadhi. Samadhi sometimes is translated as concentration, sometimes it's translated as immersion, sometimes it's left untranslated. In modern times it already almost have become like an English word, so I generally prefer to not even translate it. But there are various ways we could translate it for a person who has no basic knowledge of yoga and Buddhism and so on. So one is union, one is concentration, one is immersion. These are all words which describe this, describe a meditative state of mind. Now, a meditative state of mind does not necessarily mean that we sit in a certain posture. Now, that is how we start off cultivating meditative states, by finding a suitable and comfortable posture. But it is important to not hold on to this image, because many people hold on to this image that you only can have samadhi when you're sitting cross-legged and with eyes closed. This is how you start, but ultimately you need to learn to cultivate that state in all postures, whether you're sitting, standing, lying, or walking. And there are four kinds of samadhi, or the Buddha gave four kinds of main meditations or meditative accomplishments that he many times talked about, and that he declared to be right concentration, right samadhi, an important factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. And that are, the first meditation is a meditation wherein you still need to apply your mind to your meditation, to your body, to your mind, to your internals. Now you're trying to move into the inner sphere of things, into the inner meaning of things. So in order to get there, in order to get out of the sense sphere world, you have to apply your mind to your body, to your breath, to some meditation topic that you have chosen that inspires you. And by means of that, you seek to develop a condition of sustainment, of a condition wherein your mind remains inside yourself without being pulled and pushed around by outside things. You want to have a mind that is sustained within yourself. And that is the second meditative factor, the factor of sustainment of mind. And if you can develop that, after some time, if you become skillful with that, then gradually joy will arise, interest will arise in your meditation, interest in what is happening with your meditation. And that is a third factor of meditation, the joy, then when this joy becomes more balanced, now you become used to being a joyful person, then gradually a sense of contentment and an inner happiness develops, which is a more balanced state. And this in turn will gradually lead to one-pointedness, or to full union of your mind, full coming together of all your mental faculties, or we can call it full concentration. Now in the first meditation of these four main meditative attainments, now these factors will gradually, will now, they always will disappear again, they will break again. Now you get a little bit some joy, then you again need to apply your mind, now your concentration breaks, then you again need to apply your mind, then you can slowly sustain your mind for some time, and then it breaks again, then you have to again apply your mind. You can sustain it, and you have some joy, you get some happiness, you get one-pointedness, and then again it breaks. This is a condition of the first jhana, the first meditation, which is not yet very stable, but is the first entrance into the world of samadhi. Now when your mind is fully all the time sustained within yourself, and when you only have to work on remaining joyful, peaceful, happy and one-pointed, then that is a second meditative attainment. And now when even that joy becomes too gross for you, too coarse for you, it's still a little bit keeping you imbalanced. It's still not fully mature a condition of mind. So if you realize that there's this certain immaturity in this joyfulness, then you will seek to develop the third meditation attainment, wherein you can just stay happy and peaceful and one-pointed all the time. You have this continuous condition of happiness, contentment and one-pointedness. And if even that happiness and that especially if even that happiness is becoming a kind of condition you consider not balanced enough for you, because it still removes you, it still keeps you removed from perfect one-pointedness for very prolonged period of times, then you abandon even that happiness and you will have only the condition of perfect balance. Equanimity is a word sometimes used. I sometimes dislike that word because it has a certain sense of coldness to it. So I prefer to think of it as perfect balance and one-pointedness. This is a perfect meditative attainment for doing all sorts of things with your mind, with your meditation, for developing the cities, developing the capacity to see your past lives or even the past in this life, a capacity to plan your life, this life better, to work out your problems, to realize the nature of existence, the law of karma, the law of dharma. All these things are best comprehended by means of this meditative attainment. This meditative attainment, if you can get there, that is the perfect kind of samadhi for understanding anything. And that's why this kind of samadhi is what will lead to wisdom, which is the fifth of these spiritual faculties. Now, wisdom in Buddhism, usually wisdom means understanding the Four Noble Truths, understanding the law of becoming, paticca-samuppada. Now, usually it's translated as the law of dependent origination, but I also have a little bit dislike this phrase, law of dependent origination, because I feel it doesn't convey much apart from confusion. So I prefer to translate it as the law of becoming. This law, understanding this law, is regarded as true wisdom, understanding the impermanence of all phenomena, mental and material, and understanding spiritual teachings, and understanding things from the inner perspective, from the psychological perspective, perhaps from the metaphysical perspective, but from the metaphysical perspective only when it's based on one's own psychological understanding. Now, this is what is called wisdom, the capacity to understand things in relation to a bigger picture, the capacity to have to get meaning out of life. Often regarded, especially in Buddhism, this is regarded kind of as the highest of the spiritual faculties. Now, sometimes actually these five spiritual faculties are taught to, you have two on one side, two on the other hand side, and in the middle you have mindfulness. So some teachers, and there's also a sutta in which the Buddha teach the five spiritual faculties in this way, that you're supposed to balance out the faith, which is the normal translation of sadha, with wisdom, so that your wisdom prevents your faith from becoming imbalanced, but on the other hand side, your faith is preventing the wisdom to somewhat become just an instrument of cutting everything without accepting any of the, without basically accepting anything, and being too critical and cynical. So some people regard this faculty, one is the perfect balance for the other. And equally, you have this idea of samadhi is balanced out with effort, and effort is balanced out with samadhi. The idea being, effort is producing energy, but if your energy is imbalanced, then you become restless. So samadhi is supposed to balance that out, while on the other hand side, samadhi can lead to some kind of indulgence or negligence. Then you balance it out with effort, while mindfulness is said to be always useful. Now, personally, I can see the point in that scheme of dividing the five spiritual faculties in this way, but I don't like it too much. From my own perspective, I prefer to see them in a sequential manner. And I also would not agree that mindfulness is the main important factor in this, amongst these. Because actually, when you develop samadhi, if you try to develop with your meditation, many times you actually except that your mindfulness starts going down a little bit. Now, the beginning stages, you always will be, the beginning stages of your meditation, you always have to balance this sharp mindfulness with relaxation. So now you first want to start off basically with a state which is very akin to dreams. Now you, this half asleep state is more close to samadhi than this sharp waking consciousness. So in that way, I personally also do not as such agree with the idea that mindfulness is always important, because in order to develop with your meditation, you sometimes a little bit allow your mindfulness to grow a little weaker in order that you have greater relaxation, and then your mindfulness should adopt to that condition of relaxation, and then you develop again stronger mindfulness in relation to that new condition. So that's at least how I think of the spiritual faculties. And then we have in the Abhidhamma, we have three more faculties. Now the three faculties of gnosis, as they are sometimes called, or the faculties of higher knowledge, wherein the first faculty is the faculty of being able to know the unknown, which basically means that you learn to know things by means of intuition, by means of your own spiritual development, and not anymore merely through books or through hearsay. This is the first faculty of gnosis, the first faculty of higher knowledge, that you have this capacity to gain knowledge through intuition, that you can know things which you cannot find in any book, so that you understand that you can rely on yourself. And that is often thought to be the first faculty. Now that is a faculty that leads to stream entry, or this is the faculty of the stream enterer, the sotapanna, the first stage of enlightenment. When a person has acquired this faculty, then he is on the first path of enlightenment and acquired the first fruit of the path of enlightenment. And when a person makes use of this faculty more often, then gradually he will develop a faculty of knowledge, or a body of knowledge. Now he will develop a store of knowledge which gives him unshakable confidence in regard to those subjects that he has realized. Now, whether it's the law of karma, whether it's the way the mind works, whether it's the way of purification, whatever he has realized, this is his unshakable knowledge. It might get modified by further realizations, but if any person would tell him something, or if he somehow reads something which is utterly in contradiction with his realization, now he will not be able to accept. But still, this is something very different from rigidly holding on to some belief. This is a person who acquired that sense of that capacity, that faculty of intuition, that capacity to gain knowledge for himself, which will equally enable him to use that faculty to break down new knowledge, new impressions, new things that he receives, and test it out against what he already realized. So this is very different from rigidly holding on to some belief that one has acquired. because outwardly one may hold on to some kind of belief or belief system, but there will be always the shaking in the heart if it's not based on direct realization, however cold-faced and rigid and hard a person appears to the outside. There will be always that shaking in the heart, always that voice of uncertainty. So some people are very tough people. They hold on to their religion, hold on to their belief system, and they are willing to kill for it. But in reality, within their heart, there's still this shaking. While a person with direct knowledge, he may appear to be very soft, he may not appear to be very rigid, he will not fight for some belief, but he will always, he will not have to put forth effort or try to convince other people or change his environment in order to justify his convictions. Whatever happens within his heart, his convictions are set. He knows what he knows. And nothing in the world will be able to change that. But then this knowledge is not just kind of sitting in him. It's not just some store of knowledge. This knowledge will become the faculty of one who knows. It will be a faculty which will enable the possessor to see things, to perceive the world in a different manner. He will not just see arbitrary events happening around him. He will begin to live in a meaningful world, which means that he possesses a spiritual consciousness. He will no longer live in the world as part of the world. He will be seen in the world, but his consciousness does no longer belong to the world. He lives in a spiritual world. He perceives the world in a spiritual manner. And what other people perceive as the material world around them, he will perceive in a totally different manner. So maybe this is just a few ideas about this faculty and a few ideas about these 22 faculties. Principally, we can relate each of these faculties in a more deliberate manner to each of the basic facts about matter, mind, and consciousness. Now, in order to treat it as a patana condition proper, the way I've treated other patana conditions previously in some previous talks, now, principally, we could more deliberately show the difference or how the idea of a faculty builds up on the basic facts of matter, mind, and consciousness. But I've done that already in my book, and I think this is enough for now. I just would just want to suggest now this scheme that I've just been talking about. Now, it's to some degree sequential. Now, you can think of it to some degree as sequential, in that you start off with the five sense faculties. Now, that's what you are born with, and that is that are the faculties that you share with all or most human beings and most animals. While the next step, there's a certain distinction between these faculties and then the spiritual faculties. especially the five spiritual faculties that I've been talking about, of inspiration, effort, clarity or mindfulness, samadhi and wisdom. And based on these, or higher than these, are the kind of intuitive faculties or gnostic faculties of being able to understand by means of intuition and becoming possessed of direct knowledge and being able to perceive through one's direct knowledge, being able to perceive the world through one's direct knowledge. That even if you have realized how the law of karma works, that you start perceiving it all around you, that you are continuously, even in difficult situations, you should be able to see that these difficult situations will have arisen due to your karma, and you will intuit how to respond to them in the appropriate way, in the way that is in accordance with the highest law of Dhamma. And actually, I want to correct myself. I just remember having talked about the 22 faculties being part of the Patana condition of faculties, but actually the texts say that only 20 of the 22 faculties are actually belong properly into the faculty condition. So the condition, the faculty of masculinity and femininity that I've been talking about actually usually is excluded amongst the faculties when they are treated as a Patana condition. The reason for that I found quite intangible, that why I still always thought them as part of this scheme. So in either way, it may be interesting or important to understand each of the 22 faculties, or to have some clue about what all of these 22 faculties mean. So it may not be altogether wrong having treated all of them here. And maybe this is just I take as a conclusion word. I hope somebody will gain some benefit from understanding these faculties.